Sup, you beautiful bastards. You're watching the Philip DeFranco Show. I hope you had a fantastic Thursday afternoon, Friday morning. And I'm glad you're here because we have a lot of news to talk about today. So let's just jump into it.
Starting with
OJ Simpson is dead at the age of 76. Or as the Drudge Report put it, cancer murders OJ. Which, yeah, I was unaware the guy even had cancer. But as you might expect, most of the reaction online has been either rejoicing or joking. With, for example, Satan tweeting, OJ Simpson just arrived down here. What the fuck? With people asking Satan, can you ask him who killed his wife? Which Satan said he's waiting for his lawyer to get down here before he answers. Which surprised some, because they thought that at least one of them was already down there. Let's see, other top comments, gone too late. RIP, I know he's looking up at us right now. Finally, OJ can rest knowing his wife's killer is dead. Though this is there are also people that are disgusted by people leaving those comments. But all I can really say with this news is that I hope that the families of Nicole Brown and Ronald Goldman, that they have some peace today.
And then
let's play a little game called Out of Touch or Bad at Math, with this week's contestant being Fox News host Jesse Waters. Because as you might have seen this week, he had a take that went very viral because he was on a podcast responding to the news that California just raised the minimum wage for fast food workers to $20 an hour. Which, if you're unfamiliar with the move, it applies to limited service restaurant chains with at least 60 locations nationwide. Though of course this is unaffected, businesses are still probably going to feel pressure to raise their own wages to compete for labor. And all that is a general statewide minimum wage in California is $16. And you know, with this news, we saw a lot of different reactions, with a lot on the left celebrating the reforms as a victory for workers' rights, with supporters saying it's the least California could do to help people with the rising cost of living, and it should actually do even more. But this is, you have a number of people on the right saying, no, employers are now going to have no choice but to either lay off staff and or raise prices or even go out of business. And among those not happy with the move was Jesse Waters, who said that fast food workers simply don't deserve that money. And to try to make his point, he decided, hey, why don't I try to do some math? And if you haven't already seen this clip, let's test it out with you as well. When I tell you that fast food workers are going to be making $20 an hour, how much do you think that is as far as a yearly wage? What is their yearly salary? I'm giving you 3, 2, 1. Here's Jesse Waters' take.
You're very good at math, so see if you can do this in your head. You probably can. If you're making $20 an hour to work at a fast food restaurant, all right, is that six figures? Are you making
No, 40 grand.
50 grand. 50 is just 2x it and add a few zeros.
Yeah. Okay, so
40K a year.
It's Jesse boy a little off. Like in the same way as if a guy said he was rocking 10 inches but only had 4. But then Jesse, he goes, you know, I know how I can save face here. I'm gonna jump from an individual worker to a family of fast food workers. And so he took a second swing at math.
Yeah. So, and then if your husband or wife is also there, you're making $100,000 as a family.
Sure.
Both working at McDonald's?
80 yes. grand.
That is, okay, that's crazy.
My man fucked up 40 times two. Why have we lifted so many unserious people to serious positions? Yeah, even two workers making $20 an hour do not approach six-figure incomes, and that's without mentioning taxes. But for Jesse, him being wrong back to back, that's not the point here. He still says it's still too much.
That is crazy. Because that job really doesn't require much.
And so with those moments going viral, unsurprisingly, we saw those on the left skewering him.
Working in fast food is incredibly difficult. It is taxing to your body,
yeah,
to your soul when you're dealing with customers all day long. Looking down at workers, people who want to make an honest living, and demanding that they get paid less for their work is just incredibly gross.
That's yeah. insane. What does your job require, you asshole? You don't do anything. You just sit there, sexually harass the staffers, and just read whatever your producers wrote on a teleprompter, you donkey.
How much does Jesse Waters make? I'm gonna look this up right now. Let's take a look. Let's figure it out. Jesse Waters' salary.
$5 million a year.
You know, with all that, especially because so many different people in so many different places, they watch this show. I gotta ask you, what are your thoughts here? And understandably, there's two stories. One, I mean, what are your thoughts on Jesse Waters just making an ass of himself trying to do math? But also two, what are your thoughts when it comes to the minimum wage? You know, someone that's lived in California for a while, I'm more familiar with the costs here. So that's gonna affect my thoughts on what the minimum wage should be. And so if you're in another state where the cost of living is lower, you might have a different take. But also, if I can add one thing, and it is something that I have a gripe with. The argument, and this is kind of very more focused on like the food services industry or coffee shops or just things that aren't traditional restaurants. I think a lot of employers have the knowledge that they are not paying their employees enough. And I think part of that is showcased with the fact that how has everything in the last 5 years become a tippable transaction? And I say this as someone that tips every time. But for things as small as like I'm buying a coffee at a coffee shop, there's a turn of the screen at that transaction now. Either reading 15, 20, 25%, or some places 20, 25, 30%. And understand that's been embraced because employees employers do not want to raise the price of their products and they don't want to pay their people better. But they're still passing off an extra cost to the consumer. It's just that they're doing it in a way that's not technically that, and it's an awkward interaction for a lot of people. It just becomes about optics. They don't want you to see prices that raised 15% so they can, you know, actually pay their employees a more livable wage, but you're still paying it. And then this is one of the wildest bits of news that you've probably never heard about. In Vietnam, a billionaire real estate tycoon just got sentenced to death for her role in the country's biggest ever fraud case, with the BBC describing this whole thing as the most spectacular trial ever held in Vietnam for one of the greatest bank frauds the world has ever seen. Right, and at the center of this, you have a woman by the name of Trong My Lan. She's 67 years old, and she was found guilty of embezzlement, bribery, and violations of banking rules, with prosecutors saying that the total damages amounted to $27 billion. Right, and so basically, what happened is that Lan managed to accumulate over 90% of the shares of Saigon Commercial Bank. And that, even though Vietnamese law prohibits anyone from holding more than 5% of the shares in any bank, with prosecutors saying that she circumvented the law through hundreds of shell companies and people acting as her proxies. And then with that power, she appointed her own people to senior positions, who she then ordered to approve hundreds of loans to the network of shell companies that she controlled. And over a period of 11 years, from 2012 to 2022, those fake loans reportedly accounted for 93% of the total credit the bank had issued, with Lan herself actually keeping $4 billion of cash in her basement. Which just is a fun fact, a way to contextualize this. Even if all of that was in Vietnam's largest denomination banknotes, that would have weighed 2 tons. And then on top of that, she allegedly sent a $5 million bribe to a former chief inspector at the central bank, which also notably that inspector has been sentenced to life in prison. And also, it's important to note it's just not those two. Lan was actually tried alongside 85 others in this case, with nearly 2,700 individuals, including 200 lawyers, being summoned for this 5-week trial. And all the documents related to the trial kept in 105 boxes, apparently weighing over 6 tons. Which also brings us to the broader context of this trial, which is that it is part of a massive push to crack down on corruption in the country. In fact, it's a campaign known as Blazing Furnace, and it's led to the indictment of thousands of people and the resignation of two presidents. With experts saying this is the most wide-reaching anti-corruption campaign in the history of the Communist Party of Vietnam, which is also why this trial has been so widely publicized. They want to put on a show. They want to make a statement. In fact, David Brown, a retired U.S. State Department official with long experience in Vietnam, telling the BBC, "There has never been a show trial like this. In the communist era, there has certainly been nothing on this scale." And so with that, I think, yeah, you know, with so much information coming from the state and state media, it is good to take all this in with a healthy degree of skepticism. But also, with saying that, there's really nothing to indicate that the charges against Lan are politically motivated. And though she's denied the charges, her defense apparently has been that she joined the banking industry without sufficient experience, with her blaming a, quote, lack of understanding of legal matters. Though I will say, it is very hard to imagine someone pulling off a scam like this by accident. Though this also, as there is a massive debate around the death penalty in this case, with depending on where you go online, people very split on this. Right? Some saying the death penalty for crimes involving money, that's absolutely crazy. But then you go somewhere else and others very supportive of it, arguing that statements like this have to be made in a world where large companies and top executives usually just have to pay fines. But with all that said, I gotta pass the question off to you here. Where do you land on this? And then, you know, most people have experienced the same stressful feeling of being at the bottom of a mountain of debt to the point where you can't even see a way out. And if you're feeling the stress of mounting debt, or you're feeling like your actions are reducing your debt, they're just not working, today's sponsor, PDS Debt, has a program that rolls all of your payments into one low monthly payment. And more importantly, one low monthly payment based on what you can afford. Right? And they offer options that allow you to pay off your debt in a fraction of the time, saving thousands in interest and fees. Plus, everyone with over $10,000 or more in debt qualifies, and there's no minimum credit score required. And this is PDS Debt, is a top-rated company on Google with an A-plus rating on the BBB. And right now, they'll give you a free debt analysis. It only takes 30 seconds, so just head on over to pdsdebt.com/DeFranco. You'll receive a full breakdown on how to save on interest each month and the quickest way to take care of your debt. So just go to pdsdebt.com/DeFranco and get your quick and easy debt assessment today. Because it's time to regain control of your life and live for you, not your debt. And then...
So like trying to mix oil and water... Most people assume that science and spirituality don't play well together, but it's not true. Today I want to tell you about research with the classic psychedelic psilocybin that's showing that under supported conditions, psilocybin can occasion mystical type experiences associated with enduring positive changes in attitudes, mood, and behavior.
Right, so that is Roland Griffiths. He just passed away last fall, and he was probably the world's most famous researcher on psychedelic therapy, with his 2006 paper finding that psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, can, quote, induce mystical spiritual experiences that prompt positive changes in behavior and attitude that last several months. And it's arguably the reason psychedelic therapy is something we even talk about today, with places like the New York Times even noting in Griffiths' obituary that the paper wasn't just groundbreaking, it was mind-blowing, ushering in what many called a renaissance renaissance in psychedelic research. But now more recent reporting from the Times has given us reason to look at Griffith's research and really the whole psychedelic renaissance that it spawned with a more critical eye. Because basically, the Times got their hands on the ethics complaint that was filed against Griffith before he passed away. And that coming from Matthew Johnson, who's another big name in psychedelic research who we've actually had on the show before, and who has also been a longtime colleague of Griffith's at Johns Hopkins University, with it alleging that Dr. Griffith ran his psychedelic studies more like a New Age retreat center than a clinical research laboratory, acting like a spiritual leader and infusing the research with religious symbolism in order to steer volunteers towards the outcome that he wanted. And with all this, Joanna Kempner, a medical sociologist who reviewed the complaint for the Times, saying, "These are serious allegations that need to be investigated." Now with this, to be clear, this is not about maligning Griffith's memory or his work. In fact, some of the issues that we're going to touch on today were acknowledged by Griffith himself. And it's also not to dispute a huge body of research showing that psychedelics have real potential for treating psychiatric disorders like anxiety, depression, PTSD, and addiction. In fact, as I've made clear on the show, I am an advocate of its medical use. But it is more to highlight that there are smart and qualified people who say that the hype surrounding psychedelics has moved faster than the science. For example, even as the use of psychedelics has skyrocketed in both young and middle-aged adults in the US, with research even showing that psilocybin is like the most popular one, we actually only have one head-to-head study comparing psilocybin with a traditional antidepressant, with neither one really coming out on top. And with the authors of that study noting that more research is needed. And Eiko Fried, a psychologist at Leiden University in the Netherlands, published a paper saying that psychedelic science is facing serious challenges that threaten the validity of core findings and raised doubt regarding clinical efficacy and safety. And with that, telling the Times, the inferences drawn in the literature at large certainly don't follow from the evidence. And similarly, Nora Volko, the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, saying, "Psychedelic drugs have been promoted as a potential cure for many health conditions without adequate research to support these claims," as well as noting that there are businesses that are very eager to make money by marketing substances as treatments or cures. And so with all of that, these new allegations against the person who sort of started this are definitely worth talking about. But also, before we get into that, I want to make one important disclaimer, which is Johnson and Griffiths didn't really get along, at least toward the end of their time working together. The pair reportedly arguing frequently over how to talk to volunteers and the public, and colleagues at Johns Hopkins reportedly weren't a big fan of Johnson either, with allegations that he acted unprofessionally, leading to his removal from a leadership position, with everything eventually leading to his resignation. So of course, with that, some might think that Johnson was just acting out of spite. You know, maybe that is true, but as I mentioned, while Johnson's complaint is sort of the starting point for this discussion, he's in fact only one of many to raise these sort of issues. Right, so with that said, let's dig into it deeper. You know, Griffiths, before studying shrooms, spent several decades publishing research on other mood-altering drugs, with his most well-known contribution being the discovery that caffeine is in fact addictive. But in the 1990s, Griffiths had an experience that changed him.
I took up a meditation practice that really altered a core sense of self for me. And it got me asking questions about the nature of spirituality and mystical experience, and how some of these kinds of sudden insights and mystical experiences can dramatically change people.
And as Roland goes on to explain, he began thinking about how this newfound interest in the mystical could fit into his existing research. And he also met a guy by the name of Bob Jesse around this time, a former tech exec who ran the Council on Spiritual Practices, which is a nonprofit that says it's dedicated to making direct experience of the sacred more available to more people. So with funding from Jesse's organization, Griffiths began recruiting volunteers for his first study on psilocybin, with his team reportedly passing out flyers that said seeking persons committed to spiritual development for a study of states of consciousness. Which brings us to Johnson's main criticism against Griffith's research. You know, about steering results in the direction he wanted, with Michael Pollan, who co-founded the UC Berkeley Center for the Science of Psychedelics, noting that there were no stone-cold atheists among the participants. Instead, participants included an energy healer, a former Franciscan friar, and an herbalist, with the volunteers being given the pill, either actual psilocybin or the placebo, in a chalice-shaped incense burner from Mexico. And in the room where they did it, there was a selection of spiritual books and a Buddha statue. And so when you take in all that information, the results might seem a lot less surprising. Now with this, I should note that when the study was published in 2006, many other researchers praised Griffith's work for its rigor. But at the same time, Griffith's paper didn't mention the Buddha or the chalice or the flyers. It just said that the participants were adults reporting regular participation in religious or spiritual activities. And other researchers like Natasha Mason, a psychopharmacologist at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, noted Griffith's mystical experiences results were very high compared to other groups. Right, for example, Rick Strassman, a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico, had performed a study on psilocybin before Griffith's. And notably, only one individual in that study, a religious studies major, had a mystical experience. So someone else in that group thought that they had been abducted by aliens. And again, with this, I want to be very clear. This is not about criticizing Griffiths. You know, he was actually somewhat open about these shortcomings, reportedly even telling Pollan that his team was interested in a spiritual effect and was biasing the condition initially, with him also acknowledging in a press release at the time that the research tread a fine line between neuroscience and areas most would consider outside science's realm. But importantly, all these issues weren't just about his 2006 study. They were also about Griffith's overall style of research. So for example, we have someone by the name of Manoj Das. They worked with Griffiths on some of his later studies, and they told the Times that he was also taken aback back by the forced mystical atmosphere of the studies. And notably with this, Das also wrote a blog post saying that he is increasingly frustrated by the tendency of the field to make lofty claims about the drugs that stray from the realities and limitations of the data. And going back to Johnson's complaint, he also recounted an instance where Griffiths actually asked at least one volunteer to reconsider her written rating of the spiritual significance of a session, which apparently specifically happened as part of the study that eventually became the most cited paper in the field, a study investigating whether psilocybin could help people cope with cancer. And actually with that, one participant in the study committed suicide a week after storming out of his first session, with reports saying that he was frustrated that he didn't feel the effects of the drug. And though Roland reported the incident to regulators, he allegedly urged his team to keep a lid on. And with that, you have a former mentee of Dr. Griffiths, Natalie Gukashian, actually talking about this in a paper about the risk of psilocybin-assisted therapy, writing, "With recent media portrayals of psychedelics as cure-all drugs, patients who have failed to find relief from other treatments may come to see psychedelics as a last resort. If a study participant believes they have received a much-hyped treatment and still fails to see improvement, demoralization and hopelessness may ensue." And again, I gotta stress this, in a world of out-of-context clips and one-minute attention spans, this is not about pinning everything on Griffiths. As Gukashian says, the media has played a major part in creating this hype. And actually, Griffiths wrote a paper in 2022 warning about a psychedelic hype bubble driven largely by media and industry interests. But this also, as he was one of the most public and vocal advocates for their use, often appearing on big talk shows and podcasts, with him saying things on those like,
"Excitingly, exploration of the psilocybin occasion mystical experience will surely reveal underlying biological mechanisms of action, will likely result in an array of therapeutic applications. And more importantly, because such experiences are foundationally related to our moral and our ethical understandings, further research may ultimately prove to be crucial to the very survival of our species."
And so with all that, the way that I want to close this segment out, because you've been so kind to listen to myself and these clips just yapping, is that even when you are excited about something, you might even be an advocate for something, you should take time to consider and look at things that potentially detract from that. Because, you know, I can share the story of when I took mushrooms, it was honestly so much better than any antidepressant I've ever taken in my life. But that story is personal to me. It's anecdotal. And the point of having more research and why we should all call for more research of things that we're against and for is the pursuit of truth, even though sometimes the truth can be complicated or nuanced. Like with this, maybe certain aspects have been overstated on certain parts. And if you're right, the research just makes your footing even more solid. But with all that, I gotta pass the question off to you. What are your thoughts here?
And then,
did you know that nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've just forgotten about? Which I will say, before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had maybe 7 subscriptions. Yo, I guess just from like making companies and like, I had 4 Netflix accounts. I was so angry, and it was the worst angry because I was angry at myself. That's a no-win angry. And in general, I couldn't believe how many subscriptions I had each month, like things that I'd use for a certain period of time and then just forgot about. I mean, between streaming services, delivery services, everything, freaking services, it's never ending. But thanks to the sponsor of today's show, Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Because with Rocket Money, you can see all your subscriptions in one place. And then you see something you don't want, Rocket Money helps you cancel it with a few taps. And I like how their dashboard shows me this month's spending compared to last month, so I can clearly see my spending habits. Plus, they offer to help you create a custom budget and keep your spending on track. And get this, they'll even try to negotiate to lower your bills by up to 20%. All you gotta do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you, which is why it's not surprising that Rocket Money has over 5 million users. They've saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, and they save members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/PDS. It's that simple. That's rocketmoney.com/PDS. rocketmoney.com/PDS.
And then,
I'm really interested to know what y'all are going to think about this, right? Because moms accused of neglecting their children are getting paid $500 a month. Right, and that because this is actually part of a program that'll study whether extra income can improve the lives of families enough to prevent the need for the government to take away children and separate families. It's being run by the anti-poverty organization Mothers Outreach Network in conjunction with the Harvard Law School's Access to Justice Lab. And the idea is to see if you give low-income families more money, does it help mitigate the problems that contributed to the neglect in the first place? With the program specifically to distributing funds to 12 low-income black mothers in Washington, D.C., who were investigated for child neglect by the district's Child and Family Services Agency. And so from now until October, those 12 randomly enrolled mothers will receive $500 a month and then get a lump sum of around $3,000. Right, and more specifically, this study focuses on people who have had claims of child neglect investigated and substantiated by the CFSA, but who are also still allowed to keep their children at home. And as it turns out, that's not necessarily uncommon, right? As neglect can be defined as a range of things like a child lacking food, shelter, supervision, or education. And so as a result, officials can take a range of actions depending on the severity of the neglect, like offering child care resources for less serious cases or removing children from homes for more serious ones. And Jim Greiner, the faculty director at the Access to Justice Lab, he made clear that mothers won't be eligible for the program if the neglect allegations against them were severe enough to have their child removed from their home. But also with this, you know, you have some people saying, hey, neglect is neglect. Why are we paying people who neglect their children? You know, that's something that Greiner's even acknowledged, conceding that some people might think it's a terrible idea because it's going to provide a monetary incentive to neglect children. With that, adding that others think that the underlying problem is poverty, in which case providing money is a fantastic idea because it'll directly alleviate the problem. You know, that was also echoed by Claire Anderson, a senior policy fellow at the University of Chicago's Chapin Hall, who told the Post, there's a societal narrative that child abuse and neglect is an individual action by an individual person doing harm to a child. But saying with that, the evidence shows us that policy choices are contributing significantly to the activation and deployment of child protective services in the lives of families. And Anderson, pointing to the fact that decades of research have repeatedly shown that families who have less access to money, housing, food, legal support, and other services are more likely to be investigated for child neglect. In fact, studies have found that an overwhelming 85% of families investigated by child protective services nationally, they had incomes that were below 200% of the federal poverty line. Right, so $49,720 for a family of three. You even had the director of the CFSA emphasizing the huge role that poverty plays in the system, saying, I have no doubt that poverty plays a huge role in how most of the families come to CFSA's attention. You know, like with all things concerning poverty in the U.S., there are major racial disparities. For example, Black children and families making up an outsized portion of people involved in the child welfare system. In fact, half of all Black children experience a child protective services investigation by the time they're 18. And in D.C. specifically, CFSA data shows that a majority of the children served in their homes or in foster care during the first quarter of this year were Black, which is why this program is specifically being applied to Black mothers exclusively right now. Melody Webb, the executive director of Mothers Outreach Network, explaining, the system is penalizing families and taking children away from their homes for being poor. We also want to combat negative narratives about Black women, Black mothers in particular, whose children are involved in the system. And so with this, you know, I think whatever results we see from this, it's going to be very interesting. Because as I often say, whoever first said, mo money, mo problems is wrong, it's definitely more money, different problems. Because while anecdotal, I will say the times in my life where we had no money, right? I'm a trailer park kid. Those were the hardest of times. But with that said, I got to ask, what are your thoughts on this study?
And then
in huge international news, you know, as Russia continues its war against Ukraine, this much smaller country is finding itself in desperate need of troops. In fact, so much so that Ukraine's parliament just passed a new law amending how the draft works, who's eligible, and the penalties for draft dodgers. With lawmakers having discussed this law for months, also dragging their feet on this issue, and that's likely because they knew that it would be extremely unpopular. But seemingly, they've been spurred into action after military commanders came to speak to them this week. And during those speeches, lawmakers learned just how bad the situation in Ukraine's east really is. Because over there, Russian troops outnumber Ukrainian ones 10 to 1. And in some of the lucky parts, it's just 7 to 1, which is just too major of a difference, and it makes anything more than just desperately holding on to territory impossible. And the military pretty much said all of that bluntly. With this, President Zelensky still has to sign the law, which he is expected to do, although he was probably hoping that other measures would have been enough. Because the law had already been changed once to lower the draft age to 27, and then Zelensky used other emergency measures to drop it again to 25 temporarily. With now this new law making that a permanent fixture and giving other mechanisms to lower the age again if needed, which most military commanders want. But also with this, you know, that is in effect without up-to-date information about would-be draftees. So the law now gives Ukrainian men 60 days to update their draft information or they face penalties. Although notably, those penalties aren't nearly as bad as the early versions of the bill wanted, with this version instead being just large fines and really kind of a slap on the wrist in the grand scheme of things. But just updating that information alone is expected to help a ton. Or like imagine if the US implemented a draft again and they relied on the selective service card that men filled out when they were 18. Now, most of us don't live in that same spot anymore and we aren't required to update it. So that information would be so out of date that it's borderline useless, which is exactly what Ukraine's struggling with. Also, since I think it's understood that getting drafted into the military, that just sucks, Ukraine is also trying to offer a carrot, right? Try to make things a little better for those who decide to volunteer instead by one, raising their pay, and two, also making this an option for some convicts. Although notably, that is not expected to move a massive number of people. Also, something that the law fails to do, which will likely fuel its unpopularity, is limit how long someone can serve. Currently, it is open-ended service, and there have been Ukrainians fighting on the front lines for 2 years. And because there is an increasing shortage of manpower, many haven't been rotated out, which is actually a much bigger deal than you may realize. Now, like we learned over 100 years ago that during World War I, rotating the front lines helps a ton. It keeps soldiers more sane, more effective, and otherwise they get battle fatigue. But if this draft law actually works as lawmakers hope that it does, then the soldiers might actually get some rest. Although with this, not at least till mid-May after recruits are trained. And even with that, Ukraine's commanders told politicians to not expect any miracles. Because despite how much they have fucked up in this war, Russia's military has become increasingly competent and better armed. Whereas Ukraine's in this situation where they just really need weapons, which is another reason lawmakers wanted to pass this. With many feeling that it would show international partners that they're serious, they are desperate, which would then hopefully open up the flow of weapons again. And in some some instances, that may work. Or with the EU Parliament now actually doing the opposite of Republicans here at home. They are blocking funding for certain functions of the EU unless the delivery of advanced Patriot weapon systems is approved. And this is, of course, Republicans here in the States continue to block real aid to Ukraine. Because the US has still managed small sales here and there, but the massive aid packages of ammo and guns that Ukraine has begged for continue to be held up. And seemingly, the only way that changes is if the election goes a certain way in November, both at the presidential level and the congressional level. And either way, from now till then, Russia is just continuing to ramp up its pressure and constant missile strikes against Ukraine.
And then,
finally, today we have me just kind of yapping about some stuff I found interesting, and yesterday, today, as far as the yapping. I had a number of y'all tweeting at me yesterday saying I willed something into existence, and that is that after my random rant around Heroes, it was reported Heroes reboot in the works from series creator Tim Kring called Heroes Eclipse, but they reportedly set years after the events of the original series, featuring familiar villains and new enemies. Though I will say, I am skeptical if it is gonna be good. I will have hope, but there's just something about that first season that was like, it was lightning in a bottle. Also, regarding entertainment, I got two more things to say. One, I was happy to learn in the last 24 hours that Project Hail Mary, the movie, one, not only has Gosling in it, but two, will be coming out in 2026. I know I've said it now multiple times in the past. If you have not listened to or read Project Hail Mary, it's great sci-fi, mainstream, consumable sci-fi that's still like perfectly nerdy enough. And the final entertainment thing I'll say is it feels like there's just a lot of good stuff happening right now. I felt like there was this at least 2 month drought for a while, but there's so much good stuff. I did a double feature last weekend of Monkey Man and Late Night with the Devil. Both phenomenal. I also got to say Dev Patel is just a fucking amazing. I'm going to try to sneak away to see Arcadian and Civil War. Also, the new Fallout series just came out. I'm only one episode in, but fucking fantastic so far. But anyway, I'm done gushing about that. Let's talk about those comments yesterday. Starting with a lot of people saying they feel bad about giving their parents so much shit when they were a kid for not giving them Lunchables. Right, Catherine saying, I used to be so jealous of the kids who got Lunchables. Now I'm going to call my mom and apologize. And Hyperwolf saying, thanks, Mom, for never buying us Lunchables. I used to ask my mom why we weren't allowed them, and she'd just say, I love you too much to feed you garbage. Even saying, I got bullied for not having Lunchables as a kid a few times until I told the other kids their parents didn't love them if they bought them that garbage. Never got picked on again. Though notably, you had folks like Gnome saying, Anthony Bourdain said it best. Everybody should eat healthy. Everybody should eat organic. But when it comes to feeding your kids on a budget, mom is going to pick 99-cent cheeseburgers over $5 salads. Until we start making it affordable to eat healthy, we can't complain that our food is unhealthy. We want to say we care about children and their nutrition, but we also make it so that the average child's family can't afford proper nutrition. And then a lot of people were arguing in the replies on that about what food costs next to them. And Haiku also chiming in saying, it's pretty funny that Kraft is like, you should not focus on one single ingredient, but they fail to mention that the ingredient in question is literally lead. There's essentially saying, yeah, there is poison, but only one poison, and we added a bunch of other stuff too. And then finally, there was a lot of conversation, understandably, about Elisa Jordana. With Kilometer saying, as a Floridian, we do not claim Elisa Jordana. She's a snowbird who was born in Jersey. She could have broken up with her boyfriend the normal way instead of doing all these theatrics that absolutely put lives at risk, especially streaming while driving. South Florida roads are some of the craziest roads in the state next to I-4, and she's just gonna live stream it while talking on the phone and looking at texts? Her license needs to be revoked. With what her boyfriend did, it was scummy. And honestly, fuck that guy. But did she really have to have this mental breakdown on social media to the point where the fight in that car happened? Anything is content, anything for a view. Others adding that she needs to have her account banned for doxing Sarah, and also for abusing her boyfriend live on camera and driving recklessly, endangering other innocent drivers on the road. And Hunter saying the way that he flinched when she approached him, the way he doesn't fight back, the ease at which she attacks him while driving, I highly doubt this is the first time she's been physically abusive towards him. But that, my friends, is where today's show is gonna end. I appreciate you, I love your faces, and I'll see you right back here on Monday. You on my mind a lot, don't need no time watch. I don't know how I got you in my pocket spot. Yeah, that's bae, need you every day. You light my oxygen.